Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Jesse Green here at the control panels, as always. And today we're having a conversation that's near and dear to my heart because the topic is all about how to create a valuable business and specifically what are the drivers of value in that business. Joining me today is Lisa Singh, and she has an incredible pedigree in this area. Not only has she got a background and a degree in business, she also has a background and a degree in dentistry, where she worked as a dental hygienist for many years as well. More recently, she's been the purchasing officer for one of the large corporates, and so she's uniquely positioned to understand what corporates are looking for as they buy practices, what are the key ingredients that must be in place, how to negotiate the deal and the terms, and specifically, she's also now working as a practice broker, so she's able to see both sides of the equation. Lisa has recently taken up a role at Practice Sales Search, and she brings with her some skills, some insights that are really unique and I think are really valuable. And today, you're going to want to have a pen and paper handy because we discuss the drivers of value, how to maximize value, how to position your practice for sale. But specifically, even if you're not ready for selling your practice, it's all about creating the most valuable business that you can. So again, have a pen and paper handy because you want to take information down and go back to your practice and put it into place, put it into action. Before we do get into that conversation with Lisa, just a public service announcement. For those that have not yet come across our Earn More and Work Less video series, I'd love to share that with you. It's a free resource. It's 100% complimentary for our listeners on the show. You can head across to savvydentist.com/protips, grab yourself a copy, and in that, you're going to receive 20 or so videos delivered to your inbox in short, consumable, easy to implement chunks, 20 things that will help create more money in your life and give you more time in your life. So it's all about earning more, working less, transitioning from a self-employment situation through to true business ownership. So again, we've had some lovely feedback around that particular course and it's there for you guys as well. So again, savvydentist.com/protips, grab yourself a copy and enjoy it. I hope you find that really helpful. But for now, let's get on with our conversation with Lisa. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I enjoyed talking to Lisa. Lisa Singh, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us. How are things with you today?
Things are really well. Can't complain. It's a beautiful day down here. Up here, quarter from Canberra.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. We were talking off air a moment ago and you're up near the beach and you've got the waves crashing around you and all those good things. So by definition, it has to be a good day with that kind of backdrop.
It's always a beautiful day up here in the Gold Coast. Well, right on the border of the Gold Coast, New South Wales.
Yeah, it's lovely. Now, Lisa, you've got a really interesting background and you're currently working at Practice Sales Search and you're an agent there and you're able to help people list their practices and sell them, but you've got a really rich and interesting background. How did you find your way into that kind of work?
It sort of happened by accident. I think that's these days kind of what linear careers are not the norm anymore. But I started out my degree in business in uni in the States, absolutely loved it. Kids came along and working 60 to 70 hours a week, I had to make a decision. Long story short, I stayed at home with them as they were growing up when they were little, absolutely loved it. And I wanted to get back into career force. And my best friend, she was a hygienist, her husband was a dentist. And over some glasses of wine, maybe one or two, we had some conversations. And I went back to dental schools. I became a hygienist because of the flexibility with having young children. Mm-hmm. Did that for several years. Unfortunately, I had a marriage breakdown, but then over time, I met an Australian. And that's what brought me to this lovely country. And when I came here, I wanted to get back into the workforce, but doing dental because I absolutely loved it. I had to wait for my qualifications to become recognized. And during that time, I was just to learn the lingo. Because you count your teeth differently here than compared to the States. It's yes. A lot of little things.
Yep, we do.
So I stumbled across at that time, they were known as Dental Partners, and they were looking for a regional operations manager. And I figured that would be a good place to start to put my feet under the desk and learn more about the dental industry. And one thing led to another, and I stayed there just until recently. So that's how I landed working in the operational side of things instead of the clinical.
Wow. So you've really been able to combine that early business career plus dentistry and bring the two together.
Yeah. And it's been fabulous because it's nice when I'm speaking to a dentist, when in the early days, when it was the operational side of things, I knew what their perspectives were. And then later on in my career with Dental Partners, which then changed the name to Maven, I was looking at a buying perspective. And I know what their push points were. I know where a lot of the aggravation came from. I know what made them happy. Not everyone, but I, being a clinician myself, I know what fears they had, especially if you had a perio patient in the chair. And if, you know, a so-called corporate would come in and say 10-minute patient in and out, bums on seats, that's not what they wanted to have their practice sell to or be told they had to do.
Yep.
And that those are the couple of worries and fears that I can talk to them about.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And just going back to that early conversation you had over a few glasses of wine, it's amazing how small little things can change, you know, your career trajectory and, you know, ultimately go down a really different path. And I think, yeah, it's really interesting. I'm always fascinated with people's backstory because, as you say, the linear path is not so common these days. And obviously, yours has been anything but linear too. I wanted to ask you a moment because you've been around dentists and dentistry and the business of dentistry for quite some time now, and you would have seen a lot of change over the last few years in particular and even though the last decade. What sort of trends have you seen that have really shaken up the way dentistry is done here in Australia particularly, but also overseas? And I guess following on from that, where do you see the future going?
Oh, that's a crystal ball moment. I wish I knew all those answers. I think marketing has played a tremendous role in dentistry. In the States, now I haven't practiced that long in the States, but very little marketing. From my experience there, it's you go to your local dentist, and just to give some reference, I was from South New Jersey. Mm-hmm. The corporate's not much presence there at all. Some, but not much. So you went to your local dentist, maybe where your parents brought you to or nearby, and if you like that person, you stayed there and it was word of mouth. And then I came to Australia and I realized that corporatization here was brand new. Mm-hmm. And of course, I landed on the Gold Coast and there was heavy marketing in this area. And I didn't realize the power of, and also the generational side of things, looking at your phone, Googling, what's the best dentist? Because that's going to tell you the right answer.
Exactly.
That was the most powerful thing that I think that's where it's going today is how to market your practice effectively to get those patients through the door, but then using your skills to have them stay.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned you've had your career with Dental Partners, now Maven, and you started off in operations and you've progressed through into other roles. Can you give us a little bit of your history in that particular company? Because again, it's a fascinating story and I'm curious to understand what the evolution has been for you there.
So when I started with Dental Partners, they were pretty new, about a year old, looking, growing as an aggregator because the first corporate in Australia at that time was Dental Corp. Mm-hmm. And then Dental Partners came about shortly afterwards to grow their company. Mm-hmm. And so when I joined with them, they were looking for somebody to sort of look after a cluster of practices because they didn't have a cluster. They were so new. Mm. It was spread out. So there were a few practices in Canberra. There was Queensland, heavier in Queensland, not by any reason, maybe just because where their head office was based. So I was looking after, at the end of my operations role, almost 25 to 28 practices as a regional, not a practice manager, but to help them grow their business. Almost like what you do, Jesse. I'm looking for areas of opportunity, any types of, you name the type of pressure or situation they're in, look for reasons to find ways to ease it because we're a corporate. Our job was to help change some of those pressures so that way life can be a little bit easier from the practice dentistry.
Yep.
And to take that burden off of them. So I did that for, to start at 2011. I did that till about 2013. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were more aggregators came into the market. So it wasn't just DentaCorp, which got bought by Bupa. So it wasn't just Bupa anymore. And we had an aggressive growth strategy. And I got tapped on the shoulder to see if I wanted to go into the acquisitions role, since with my business background and also the rapport that I built with the dentist.
Yeah.
And wasn't sure if I was going to be good at or successful at it, but I took the leap and I absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. And I fell into that role until recently when Maven put a pause on acquisitions.
So I really want to explore that part of your role, the acquisitions side of your work with Dental Partners and later Maven as it became. And for people listening to this podcast, they'll be curious to understand some of the decision-making processes, some of the thoughts that go through the minds of the acquiring team in terms of what they're looking for in a practice. So, you know, what sort of things might a corporate look for in a practice that they're looking to acquire? What are the green lights and what are the red flags?
Well, let's be honest here. One of the most important things is the profitability of the practice.
Of course, yeah.
So you have to have a certain amount of profitability. Each one, now that I'm on the other side, I know a bit more about the other ones. But with Maven, you wanted to have a profitability that, you know, you're talking around $300,000 in EBITDA.
Yeah.
Is probably, not to say that you haven't bought less, and of course they would buy more, but that's around an area that you can probably bank on that you might be looked at from a corporate perspective.
Yeah.
So with that, to have that type of profitability, you have to have a certain amount of turnover because they go hand in hand.
Yes.
So you're probably looking at over $1 million in turnover.
Yep.
Then it comes to your chair size. If they were going to buy a chair practice with one or two chairs in it, not to say they wouldn't, but there has to be a growth plan.
Yes.
And a growth plan that comes with minimal expense.
Yes.
So you want to look at least a 3-chair-plus practice. If you have under 3 chairs, you want to show them a way you can grow it easily into a 3 or 4-chair practice without breaking down walls and entering new leases and things like that, because mm-hmm. that comes with extra CapEx expense.
Yeah.
And then it's even more reliant now than it was before, is your commitment to stay at the practice. Corporates, not to say they haven't, but they don't want you to walk in, walk out. They need to tie you into a longevity and earnouts, that's what they call it, mm-hmm. with the practice, because they have to find a way to keep that turnover happening. If you're going to leave the practice, and if you built that goodwill with those patients, then that profitability is not going to be there.
So again, this probably comes back to, you know, managing key person risk in the business, mm-hmm. particularly with the principal. Ordinarily, they'll have a fairly strong following within the practice. What other risks do you see that need to be addressed from the perspective of the purchaser of the practice? What other risks are there for them? You've mentioned the ability to grow with minimal capital expense. You've mentioned the earnout and tying the principal in particular. Are there any other things that could go awry there that the purchaser is looking to address?
It's become highlighted more and more. I can't stress enough, it has to be that willingness to stay long. So 3 years tends to be the minimum, but if you can say I'm willing to stay for 5 years, even more, that's probably the most important thing, because at key man dependence, yes, if you're just the one, the kid of our associates, but if you're generating over 40% of the turnover in the practice, they're going to highlight that as a risk.
Mm.
If that is the case, then you want to highlight how long you're willing to stay, because to try to find a new you, they're going to have to replace you maybe with 2 people, sometimes 3 people.
Yes.
And then is there the chair space available for that? And that's when you're not going to find the purchase price that you're looking for if you can't solve that mystery for them.
Yeah.
And then the ability to grow your practice. The corporates, let's pretend you have $1 million EBITDA practice, but it's pretty much capped out. There's not much more growth potential. You've done as much as you possibly can without breaking down walls. They still would probably buy your practice, but then how are we going to grow it?
Mm.
If you can highlight areas to grow your practice, that is very, very strategic in their sense of getting the higher multiple for your practice, because they can see how they can obviously get the return on investment and plus by being able to grow it.
So just on that for a moment, I'll come back to the multiple question in a moment, because everyone's going to ask that. But if I was planning to sell my practice, would it then be prudent for me to have a business plan of sorts mapped out that says, here's my current practice, this is where we're up to now, moving into the future, these are my plans for growth, this is my marketing plan, this is my plan around capacity, this is what we're looking to do over the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? Is that the sort of documentation that would assist in the sale of your business?
If you called me at my days in acquisition, I would hug you. I would use that when I'm going to the board of directors, because it's exactly the plan that I had to produce when I was trying to get our board of directors to invest into a practice like that, because they need to see all the red flags. It was my job to point that out, but also to see where the future is in the practice. So if you already had that mapped out and you're willing to commit to it. It's one thing to have it on paper, but if you're going to say, I'm going to step back and you guys find the right person, that's a different story.
Yeah. And I guess if they're willing to commit to it, what the owner, the vendor is saying is that I'm willing to commit to it, stand alongside me and commit with me, and I'll be there shoulder to shoulder with you. Is that kind of what they're looking for?
Exactly. You know, having that personality that says, let's do this together, we're in it together, is absolutely the type of personality a corporate's looking for. Because yes, the corporate is head office could be in the Gold Coast, it could be in Melbourne. They cannot run your practice from that location. You're still the person in charge. You're still the person who's going to have to still, believe it or not, manage those staff issues. Because let's call her Susie at the front desk is not going to call the head office and say, I'm sick today. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Either she's still going to call you or whoever you have in place to handle those things.
Yeah. 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 Fantastic. So Lisa, we've obviously started talking a little bit about multiples earlier. And you know, when it comes to valuing a practice, obviously that formula is often regarded as the repeatable, sustainable earnings times multiple. And you know, we've spoken about a few things that influence multiples, risk and growth opportunities. Are there any other factors that you think listeners need to be aware of as they're trying to work on how to get the best multiple?
It comes down to a profile of the practice with lots of different things of that risk. Capital expenditure is another thing. If they're going to look at your practice, and if you just had a recent fit out with new equipment, obviously that's going to keep you at the higher end of the multiple if you have that profitability.
Sure.
But even if you have a huge amount of profitability in your practice, but everything needs to be replaced pretty soon because it's 20 years old, that's going to affect things. So that's an easy one to be worried about. At the same time, think about which has to be replaced in the short term, because they're going to ask you those questions. And they'll actually do an audit on your practice just to see if something is going to break in the near future.
Right.
Also, they're going to ask things about your age and your health. Of course, because of that chemo independence, and even if it's not chemo independent, you're still the vendor. They're going to ask you, is there anything in your health? And they may ask you to get a certificate from your doctor that may stop you from becoming a practitioner in the near future. Location is another factor. Mm-hmm. Finding, when I was a regional manager, if I had to go out to, let's say, Northern Territory for one practice versus seeing a cluster in Sydney on a visit, that's obviously going to play a factor into what the corporate's going to look at in terms of viability of long-term finding other clusters in that practice. And that has to go with branding as well, but we can talk about that later. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lease. A lease is another risk that the corporates will look at, because if you have a lease that has a demolition clause or a relocation clause in it, who's going to want to spend X amount of dollars for your practice and then they have to pick it up and move it? It's not like it's moving a dress store.
Yeah, exactly.
So those things will, all those profile things will change the opportunity for you to sell your practice at a higher multiple.
Okay, so let's talk multiples at the moment, because again, everyone asks that question and everyone seems to have an opinion on what the multiple can and should be. And clearly it's going to vary from case to case. And we understand that we can't give it like a point estimate and say, you should get a multiple of 3x or 4x or whatever it is. But could you give us an indication of some ranges of multiples that are generally accepted in the marketplace, or is that a bit too vague?
Well, based on everything we just said, you can't take a profitability number. And I've seen this happen with advisors in the industry when they brought me practices, and even in my current role, they'll take a multiple, an EBITDA, and they'll multiply it by 5 and multiply it by 4. And they'll say, this is what you have to get.
Yep.
And they're not taking these other considerations that play a huge amount role of what that multiple should be. So if there's going to be a range, it can range anywhere, I would say, between 3 and 5. Has there been less? Yes, because of the high risk. Mm-hmm. Has there been more? I would say there has been, but because of different factors willing to de-risk that practice. So yeah, it all comes down to the risk factor in the practice.
Yeah, totally. All right. So let's just assume for a moment that the sale goes ahead, a corporate comes along and you strike an agreement, the transaction occurs. What happens then? How do you integrate into the corporate? How do you maintain that sense of self, that sense of identity, and still fulfill your obligations under the contract and become part of the corporate family without feeling like the distant cousin?
That's a great question, because I say this when I'm speaking to the vendor. I always tell them, you have to be emotionally prepared. Mm. It's one of these factors that you can have the highest amount that you could ever dream of getting for your practice. You can be extremely excited about it. And then all of a sudden you wake up one morning and say, did I do the right thing? Mm. Is this what I want to happen? What about my practice manager? What about my staff? What about my associate? These are things that now that you forgot all about the price and you're so worried about the other factors that are called soft, but they're really not soft when you build the practice mm. and you have an emotional attachment to it. So be ready for that. Be ready to have it hit you when the time comes that the practice is going to go to somebody else. And then you have to think about you when, let's say you're going to a conference and when you are the owner of the practice and you see a great microscope that you want to buy, and that's it. Put out the credit card, you're buying the microscope. When yeah. you work for a corporate, you have to talk to mommy and daddy. That's exactly what happens. So, and sometimes if you're not ready for that, that emotionally can make you a little bit more disgruntled because you no longer can buy those things that you want just because you want. But if you're ready for it, then it can be a very rewarding experience because they do assist you.
And is there anything that you think, apart from being ready, are there any other things that would make that transition easier?
It's also preparing your staff. I would not wait until the last moment if I was you selling your practice to tell them the day before the transaction happened. You wouldn't believe how many times they just, I understand they don't want, if anything should happen, them to be worried they're going to lose their job or someone's going to take over. But if you let them in early and you are honest with them and you tell them the reasons why you want to sell, you won't believe the commitment you'll have behind you.
Yeah.
Because if you're still at the practice and you're still giving a time commitment, the corporate wants them there too, because they don't want to start over from scratch with a brand new staff.
No.
So when you're honest with your team, that makes a transition so much better, because then everybody's on board to make you successful as well as them. So telling your staff early is another key thing that I think it's important when the timing's right, of course.
Yeah. And let's face it, turnover of staff impacts productivity and profitability. And if you've got an earnout, you've got to maintain your numbers. You've got to keep those revenue numbers right, and you've got to keep the EBITDA right. And turnover of staff is a killer in that.
And your staff, but also your associates.
Yes.
Your associates are very key to that production number. So you want to have that chat with them and make sure that they understand the reasons why you're selling, and if there are opportunities for them to look at becoming a lead dentist after you decide to leave, because there are opportunities for those associates in the group.
Yeah, totally. Look, I sold my first practice privately, and I just wanted to come back and talk about the emotional preparedness for that, because I was not emotionally prepared when I sold my first practice. And I have to tell you, you're so correct when you say that you need to get that sorted out, because I was not as prepared as I ought to have been in that regard. And I found that transition very hard, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So ladies and gents, if you are listening to this and you are thinking about selling a practice, whether it's to a corporate or to a private purchaser, be prepared for that change, because it is really important. It goes from being your baby to someone else's baby. But sometimes, well, at least in my case, I found it hard to hand over the keys, so to say. And you know, I don't think I'm the only person who's experienced that. Lisa, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about selling privately versus selling to a corporate, because now you've seen the other side of the fence as well. What differences and similarities would you say exist between selling to a private purchaser versus a corporate purchaser?
That's a good question, because I didn't realize there are differences when it comes to looking at, how about I do this? I'll take an instance of I'm talking to somebody now and they have an offer from both. Mm-hmm. And it's the funny thing is that when I first spoke to the person, this person wanted to have a private buyer, but after speaking to the corporates, now they're actually enjoying the fact that they can still remain the boss, if you want to use that word, of the practice, whereas a private buyer is looking to replace their production with themselves at a certain period of time.
Yes.
So that's probably the biggest difference when it comes to the emotional factor, is when you're looking to sell, do you really want to stay in the practice and be still be in charge of it, or are you looking to leave and exit probably earlier? Because that'll probably help your decision if it's not just based on price.
Yep.
And then I don't want to get too much into this, but then there's the preferred provider argument.
Yes.
So with corporates, they have their own viewpoint on that, but some of them don't look at the preferred providers as closely as a private would, because a private, there could be a heavy reliance on that preferred provider status. Mm-hmm. So that's something else that's a little bit different between the corporate and the private side of things. And then it comes to the commitment factor. With a private sale, you're probably not going to have to stay at the practice very long. With a corporate sale, they're going to ask you to stay for over 3 years.
Yeah, cool. Just on the preferred provider question for a moment, and this is putting you on the spot massively, and I realize, and again, there may not be a clear-cut answer to this, but does a preferred providership, in your mind, add value to the practice, or is it a value detractor? I understand can bring patient flow, but of course, people become reliant on that patient flow. So, it can be single source dependency around the preferred providership as well. So, where do you see preferred providerships influencing value?
I think you answered the question yourself. It depends on what the practice, the amount of reliance it has on that preferred provider status. Because if the status is no longer there, how is that going to change the profitability of the practice? So, I really don't have an answer for that when it comes down to the reliance on it and what the buyer is looking for with that risk.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Lovely. So, Lisa, we've covered a fair bit of territory in terms of talking about corporate purchasing and private purchasing as well. If I was listening to this podcast and I'm thinking that maybe the time is right now for me to start thinking about preparing for exit, what sort of things should I be working on before I come and see a broker such as yourself? What sort of things should I have in place so that I'm going to give my practice the best chance of selling and selling well?
That's a great question, because if I had every seller coming to me, I would say you have to prepare early.
Yeah.
You want to get your financials in order. You want to get them as clean as possible because they're going to do the due diligence, even a private buyer. You want to make your entities clean. So that way, as much as you can, start making sure that anything that's in there is business related only.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, also prepare your advisors. You want to make sure that people that are looking at your books know the dental market. It's a lot different dentistry than it is other industries. So if you have an accountant and a lawyer, then you want to that understands dentistry, not just your brother-in-law or sister-in-law because they're in a family and they're in the trade, that it's going to make the transaction go by very smoothly, because the last thing you want is time, because time does kill deals.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're negotiating over and over in the same circle about what a commission rate is and how to write that clause effectively, it's going to cost everybody a lot of money and you're really going to get the same answer at the end of the day anyway.
Yeah, so
prepare early, get the right advisors, and look at your holidays too, because the last three financial years is what they're going to ask for.
Yes.
But that last year is the most important. They want to see a trend going upwards, not downwards.
Yes.
So if you want to take that great holiday overseas for 6 weeks, maybe now might not be the right time. Or you want to look at it at selling, let's say you want to take it this year, but then you might want to look at putting a practice on in 18 months later, because, or unless you can find a locum or somebody to cover your production. And by the way, to talk about that, to go back to what they're looking for, if you have locums in place at your practice or people covering your production when you're away, that's a huge strength.
Yes.
Yeah, because you can tell the corporate, I went overseas for 6 weeks, and that's why there was a $400,000 drop in my turnover this year, but it's not going to change next year. Yeah, you wouldn't believe how many times I hear that.
Yeah. All the time, right?
Yeah. So look at your holidays. Try to get a replacement for you if you're going to do those holidays. And make your financials very clean and easy to decipher, because that makes everything easier when it comes time to sell your practice and to make the transition fast and smooth.
Yeah, lovely. Lisa, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, and I want to say thank you on behalf of all of us here at Savvy Dentist and all the listeners on the podcast. If we were to wrap up with a couple of key lessons or thoughts from your end about either buying a practice or selling a practice or anything in between, is there anything that you think the audience really needs to know that we've not covered about?
I think the one thing we didn't touch on as much is be flexible. Be flexible in your thinking with the purchase price, with the amount of time that you're willing to stay, with how you're going to go about the long-term strategy, even post-burnouts. You might think that you're going to hang up the tools after 3 years, but what if you're actually enjoying what you're doing now? So just be open-minded and flexible to any offer that it's presented to you, because it actually might turn out that the highest offer was not the best one because of some other things that the buyer came to you with.
That's fantastic advice. Ladies and gents, I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. There's so much gold here. I'm going to suggest you go back and listen to this podcast a dozen times, because Lisa shared some absolute pearls of wisdom there that even if you're not ready to sell your business and you're not thinking about it, It's always about building your practice to sell at some stage. And that stage might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, it might be years down the track. But creating a practice that has real value in the marketplace right now is key, because none of us knows what's around the corner, and we've got to make sure we plan for contingency. So Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time to hang with us today. I'm tremendously grateful. And if people want to find out more about where you hang out these days, what's the best place for someone to contact you?
Absolutely. Contact me at practicesalesearch.com.au. You'll find my number and email address on there, because I'm always looking at selling your practice.
Fantastic. Once again, Lisa, thanks so much. And we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you, Jesse. It was great talking to you.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.